This letter Joseph received by running messenger in his house at Menphis, and showed it to the 11, who kissed their fingertips. 1/4 of the moon they stayed in his house. It was 20 years that the father had believed him mangled. A day or so more did not matter, nor the exact moment when he should learn that Joseph was alive. And Joseph's servants served them, and his wife, the daughter of the sun, spoke them friendly words, and they talked with their aristocratic little nephews in the youth lock, Manasseh and Ephraim, who could speak to them in their tongue. The younger, Ephraim, looked more like Joseph and Rachel than did Manasseh, who took after the mothers, the Egyptian side, so that Judah said, "You will see, Jacob will favor Ephraim, and in his mouth it will not be Manasseh and Ephraim, but Ephraim and Manasseh." And he advised his brother to cut off the Egyptian youth lock above the boy's ears before Jacob came, as it would be an offense to him. Then at the end of the week they packed up and girded themselves for the journey. For there was to be a trade caravan from the kingdom, from Menphis, balance of the lands, up through the land of Canaan to Mitanni land, and the brothers were to join it, with wagons from the royal stores, 2- and 4-wheeled carts, given them with mules and drivers. Considering the 10 asses, laden with all sorts of luxurious specialties of Egypt, exclusive and costly specimens of a lofty culture and fastidious taste, presented by Joseph to Jacob, and the 10 she-asses, likewise for Jacob, whose loads consisted of grain, wine, preserves, smoked meats, and unguents, considering all this, it is clear that the brothers' own train was a stately one even by itself, swollen as their possessions were in addition by presents from their brother. It is well known that he gave to each man a change of raiment, but to Benjamin he gave 300 silver deben and no less than 5 feast-day garments, one for each of the 5 extra days in the year. That might have been the reason why he said to them as they took their leave, "Do not fall out on the way." But he really meant that they should not dwell on old times and reproach each other for what one had done behind each other's back. For it never entered his head or theirs that they could be jealous of Benjamin because he had given so much more lavishly to his own little brother. They were like lambs. They found everything in the best of order. When they were young and unruly, they had rebelled against injustice. Now it had turned out that they had come to terms with injustice, and never more had aught to object to in the great, "I favor whom I favor, and show mercy to whom I show mercy." How shall we tell him? The mind dwells pleasantly upon the marvelous correspondences which history shows. It loves to contemplate the way in which one part is balanced by another part, and one scene has its pendant in the next. As once the brothers, 7 days after Jacob had received the sign of Joseph's death, had returned from Dothan to mourn with their father, and they had been sick with dread how they should find him and how dwell with him under the half-false yet partly true suspicion that they were the lad's slayers, so now, with white hairs among their dark, they were returning again to Hebron, with the news that Joseph had not died at all, was not dead now, but living in great glory, and they were almost as weighed down with the task of telling the old man. For uncanny is uncanny, and overwhelming, overwhelming, whether the content be life or death. They were sore afraid that Jacob would fall on his back, as before. And this time, since he had got 20 years older in the meantime, he might quite simply die of joy, in other words, of shock, so that Joseph's life would be the cause of his death, and he would no longer see the living with his eyes, nor the living him with his. Besides, the truth must now almost inevitably come out, that they had not indeed slain the lad, as Jacob all the time had half believed, but yet that they had half slain him, and only by chance, not quite, thanks to the enterprise of the Ishmaelites who had taken him down to Egypt. The thought added to their pangs of conflicting joy and dread. But they drew some comfort from the thought that Jacob would be impressed, seeing they had been saved from murder by his messengers, the Midianites. This favor which God had shown the brothers would prevent Jacob from quarreling with or cursing them. They discussed all this during the whole 17-day journey, With all their impatience to bring it to an end, they even found it too short a time in which to decide how to tell Jacob in the least dangerous way, and how they would stand in his eyes once they had done so. "Children," they said to each other, for since Joseph had said, "Children, I am your brother," they often used the word to each other, though it could never have been their habit before. "Children, you will see. We shall have him falling on his back when we tell him, unless we go about it very tactfully and cautiously. But whether well or ill told, do you think he will believe what we say? The chances are he will not, for in so many years the idea of death fixes itself firmly in head and heart, and is not easily dislodged or exchanged for the thought of life. It is not welcome to the mind, for the mind clings to habit. Brother Joseph thinks it will be a great joy to the old man, and so, of course, it will be, a tremendous joy. But let us hope not too tremendous for his strength. But does a man know how to take hold of a joy straight off, when sorrow was his portion for years on end? And does he want to be told that he spent his life in a delusion, and his days in error? For his affliction was all his life, and now it is all bitterness. It is passing strange that we shall have to talk him out of something we once talked him into by means of the blood-stained garment, so that he clings to it now. And in the end, we shall suffer more because we take it away than because we did it to him in the first place. Certainly he will close his mind and not believe us, and that is all for the best. For some time, he must and may not believe us, for if he grasped it all at once, it would lay him out. The question is, how to tell him so that the joy shall not be too abrupt, and we do not suddenly thwart his settled sorrow? The best thing would be if we did not need to say anything, but could just take him down to Egypt and set him before Joseph his son, so he could see him with his own eyes and make all words superfluous. But it will be hard enough to get him down to Mizraim, onto the fat feeding grounds, even when he knows that Joseph lives there. He has to know it beforehand, or he surely will not go. But truth has not only words, it has also signs, such as the presence of the exalted ones and Pharaoh's wagons at our disposal. We will show him them, perhaps first of all before we say anything, and then explain the signs. But by the signs he will see how kindly the Exalted One means by us, and how we are one heart and soul with him we sold. So when it comes out, the old man will not be able to scold us for long, neither curse us. For can he then curse Israel, 10 out of 12? That he cannot, for it would be to kick against God's plan, who sent Joseph down thither before us as quartermaster in Egypt. Therefore, children, let us not be too fearful. The hour will come, and the moment whisper us how we shall use it. First, we will spread out the gifts before him, the pride of Egypt, and ask, "Where do you suppose they come from, father, and from whom?" "Guess." "Well, they come from the great keeper of the market down yonder. He sent them to you. But then it must be he loves you very much. He must love you almost as a son loves his father." But when we have got as far as the little word, son, then we are more than halfway. We are past the worst. And then we play for a while on the word, and finally, instead of saying the keeper of the market sent it, we say, "Your son sent it. Joseph sent it to you, for he is still alive, and is a lord over all Egypt." Thus the 11 planned and took counsel together under their nightly tent, and almost too swiftly for their misgivings, the now familiar road lay behind them. From Memphis up to the frontier fortress, through the wilderness, and then towards the land of the Philistines and Gaza, the seaport Kadati, where they separated from the merchant caravan they had marched with, and struck inland into the hills towards Hebron, in short day marches and mainly by night. For it was flowery spring when they came, and the nights were beautiful, silvered by an almost full moon. Moreover, they found very troublesome the curiosity they excited everywhere by reason of their train, swollen as it was by the Egyptian wagons, the mules and mule boys, and a herd of almost 50 asses. So they regularly rested by day, and by nightly stages pushed nearer home to the terebinths of the Grove of Mamre, where stood the father's house of Hare, and the huts of nearly all the tribe. But the last day they set out early in the morning, and by 5 in the afternoon were close to the goal, though it was still hidden by the familiar hills as they climbed the last slope. They had left the luggage a little distance back, and they rode on before it, 11 silent donkey riders who had left off talking, for their hearts were pounding in their chests, and despite all their previous planning, none of them was clear how to begin to break the news to the father without upsetting him. Now they had come to the point, all the plans misliked them. They found them stupid and unsuitable, in particular such foolishness as "just guess" and "who could it be" seemed to them frightfully out of place. Each one of them privately rejected it with scorn, and some, at the very last minute, tried to think of another idea. Perhaps they ought to send one of them on ahead. For instance, Naphtali, the runner, to tell Jacob they were all close at hand, with Benjamin, and brought great, incredible news. Incredible partly in the sense that one could not believe it, partly because it went so counter to all their habits of thought that perhaps one could not even wish to believe it, and yet it was the living truth of God. So, thought some of them, the father's heart would best be attuned to receive the news, and be best prepared for it, by a forerunner before the others came up. They rode at a foot pace. Telling the news. It was a rough, stony slope where their animals were picking their way, but strewn thickly with spring flowers. There was larger-sized rubble as well as small, but wherever there was any soil, or even, it seemed, out of the stones themselves, wild flowers gushed, blossoms far and wide, white, yellow, sky blue, purple, and rose, low bushes, mats and tussocks of bloom, a riot of gaiety and charm. The spring had summoned them, and they had blossomed at their due hour. Even in the absence of the winter rains, it seemed they drew moisture enough from the morning dew, if only for a fleeting, soon-fading splendor. Even the bushes here and there bloomed in their season, rose-colored and white. Only the merest flaky cloudlets gathered high up in the heavenly blue. On a little rock, against which a foam of blossoms beat like surf on a cliff, sat a figure, almost, as seen from afar, like a flower itself. Soon they could tell it was a little maid, alone under the wide sky, in red smock, with daisies in her hair. On her arm she held a zither, and her slender brown fingers traveled up and down the strings. It was Sarah, Asher's child. Her father was the first to recognize her, and with fatherly pride he said, "That is my little Sarah, sitting there on a stone, playing herself a little tune on her zither. The little wench is like that. She loves to sit alone and practice herself in psalmody. She belongs to the tribe of whistlers and fiddlers. God knows where she gets it. But she has had it ever since she was born. She has to make psalter and psalm. She can play on the strings till they ring, and mingle her voice in songs of praise, clearer and stronger than you could believe, seeing her wisp of a body. Some day she will be famous in Israel, the little monkey. Look, she sees us. She flings up her arms and runs toward us. Hello, Sarah! Here's your father, Asher, coming with your uncles." The child was already there. She ran barefoot through blossoms and rubble till the silver rings on wrists and ankles clashed and the yellow and white wreath bobbed up and down on her head. She laughed for pleasure and panted out breathless words of greeting. But even the gasping sounds she made had something sonorous about them, though one would not have known whence it came, her body being so frail. She was a proper little maid, no longer a child, and not yet a maiden, at most 12 years old. Asher's wife was supposed to be a great-grandchild of Ishmael. Had Sarah something in her of Isaac's wild and beautiful half-brother that made her sing? Or, since men's traits do undergo the strangest transformations in their posterity, did Father Asher's moist and sensual lips and eyes, his greedy love of sensation and feeling combined, become a musical quality in little Sarah? Perhaps it is too bold and far-fetched to trace back to the father's sweet tooth the child's love of the art of song. But some explanation there must be, so why not that, for little Sarah's strange gift? The 11 looked down from their long-legged asses upon the little maid, gave her greeting, caressed her, and their eyes grew speculative. Most of them dismounted and stood round Sirrah, their hands on their backs, nodding and wagging their heads, saying, "Well, well," and "Now, now," and "So, little music lips, have you run out to meet us and be the first to greet us, sitting here and playing on your zither like this?" But finally, Dan, nicknamed Snake and Adder, said, "Listen, children, I see by your eyes that we all have the same idea, and it is Asher who should be saying what I now say, but being her father, he does not think of it. Now, I have often shown that I am a good judge, and my native shrewdness tells me this is not just chance that the little monkey, Sirrah the song-maker, should meet us here before any of the others. God has sent her as a sign, to show what we should do. For the things we were planning about how to tell the father and hint to him so as not to harm him, that was all nonsense. Sirrah shall tell him, in her own way, so that the truth speaks to him in song, which is always the gentlest, whether sweet or bitter sweet in one. Sirrah shall go on before us and sing to him, and even if he does not believe it, at least we shall have softened the soil of his soul and shall find it prepared for the seed of truth when we follow it up with chapter and verse, and he will be forced to believe that song and truth are the same. Just as we had to believe, however hard, that Pharaoh's keeper of the market was the same as our brother Joseph. Now, have I spoken truly, and put on solid ground what hung in the air in front of all your eyes when you saw Sirrah's childish little head dreaming into space?" Yes, they said he had, and he judged correctly. So it should be. It was the hand of heaven, and a great relief. And then they took the child to instruct her and to stamp the truth on her mind. It was not easy, for they all talked at once, and one would not let another speak, and Sirrah looked with darting, delighted eyes at their excited faces and their waving hands. "Sirrah," said they, "it is thus and so. Believe it or not, just sing it, and then we will come and prove it. But it would be better if you believed it, for you would sing the better. And it is true, however unlikely it sounds. After all, you will believe your father and all your uncles together. Look now, you did not know your uncle Jehoseph, who was lost and gone, the son of the true wife, Rachel's son, who was called the Star Virgin, but he was called Dumuzi. Well, he was lost to your grandfather long before you were born, and the world swallowed him up, so that he was no more here, and in Jacob's heart was he dead all these years. But now it turns out, though hard to believe, that the truth is quite different. Oh, wondrous strange, for now the truth is plain, that quite otherwise it came to pass," Sirrah began, going off half-cocked, singing and laughing so loud and musically that the gruff voices of her uncles were drowned out. "Be quiet, little prodigy," they cried. "You can't start singing until you know what to say. Listen and learn before you warble. Your uncle Joseph has arisen. In other words, he was never dead, he is alive. And not only alive, but lives in this and this way. He lives in Mizraim, and is this and this person. It was all a mistake, you see. The bloody garment was a mistake. God has turned all to good in ways we knew not of. Have you got that? We were with him in Egypt, and he made himself known to us beyond the shadow of a doubt, saying, 'I am he, I am your brother,' and spoke after such fashion to us that he would have us all come down there, and you too, little Sirrah. Have you taken all that in, so you could give it out again in song? Then you are to sing it to Jacob. Our Sirrah is a clever maid. She will do it. Take your zither and go on ahead of us, and sing loud and resoundingly that Joseph lives. Go in among the hills, straight to Israel's camp. Look neither right nor left, but just keep on singing. If anyone meets you and asks what you mean and what you are playing and singing, make no reply. Just run and sing and sing and ring, 'He is alive.' And when you get to where Jacob, your grandfather, is, sit down at his feet and sing as sweetly as you know how, 'Joseph is not dead. He is alive.' He too will ask you what that means and what you are so rash as to say in your singing. But you must not answer him either. Just keep on twanging your zither and singing away. Then all of us will come up and explain it to him in proper words. Will you be our good, clever songbird and do all this?" "Gladly will I," answered Sirrah in her ringing tones. Never before have I had such words to string on my strings. Perhaps now I can show what they can do. Many sing in tribe and town, but now I have better matter than they, and will sing them out of the field." So saying, she took her instrument from the stone where she had sat, and held it on one arm, and spread her tapering brown fingers across the strings, the thumb here, the forefingers there. She began to move steadily through the flowers, now fast, now slow, according to the measure of her song. "Oh, let my soul sing a new song as it goeth, for a fine chant on eight strings my heart knoweth. Of what it is full, let it run over in rhyme, more precious than gold and fine gold from the mine, sweeter than purest honey in the comb, for the spring's message I bring home. Hearken all people to my harp tone sweet. Listen and mark what I may here repeat. For upon me the lovely lot doth fall, and I am chosen out among the daughters all. For given am I the strangest matter yet singer ever fell on to his harp to set. Now on my eight, my little fingers string, to grandfather old, the golden news to bring."